Would you turn to Nehemiah, the first chapter? Nehemiah 1. Now, when I used to go to some of these Protestant churches and when growing up, sometimes you say, my text for the day is... Well, I don't have a text because it's broader than that. But I thought the best way to start is just to start the story here of Nehemiah, which will help us learn an important lesson that I think it will help us all to consider anyway, because I was very much intrigued by one particular phrase that is used here in the book of Nehemiah that I think really does pertain to all of us in the Church of God here in the 21st century. Of course, this is written 500 years before Christ or so, it's 2,500 years old in history. Nehemiah was in a place in the Persian Empire actually on the Persian Gulf. And where he lived in Susa was in Elam, one of the provinces of Persia. Some people think the Elamites are Polish people today. I don't know if they are or not, but they were still around even in the time of Christ, because some Elamites were there on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2. Acts 1 and Acts 2. He was way over there, this Nehemiah, who was about 750 miles away from Jerusalem when this happened. And it's kind of interesting. Verse 1, it talks about the words of Nehemiah, the son of Eliah. His father probably lived there too, and his family over there. They were part of the dispersion that was taken away. At least his family was taken away by the Babylonians earlier on. And by this time, the Persians have taken over the empire, a kingdom of Babylonians, and now ruled. It came to pass in the month of Shivaz in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the citadel, or the king's palace that was believed to be. And one of my brethren, Hannah, and I came with some men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they came to me, the survivors who were left from the captivity in the province are in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. So here he was given some distressful news of his brethren who lived in Jerusalem and Judah, who had already gone back to Judah because of Cyrus's decree. And about 42,000 of them came, and also another 7,000 of other people came with them who were servants and helpers and so forth that wanted to go with them. About 50,000 altogether. Ezra didn't go with them. Ezra went later and did some good things and did help out to revive the true religion and so forth. And in fact, he went there on the seventh year of Artaxerxes to help the people, and because he's concerned for them. And Ezra did a lot of good things. Ezra was a ready scribe in the law, so he's able to write down the law of God, the books of the Bible up to that place, at least the five books of Moses, and have that ready for them. Later on, he brought it out in time of Nehemiah, actually, and they read the law, the whole law, during the Feast of Tabernacles and Trumpets, of course. And so the people were able to be astonished to learn all that it had to say about instructions and things to do and how to live and so forth. Not only the Ten Commandments, but many other details about different judgments and statutes and so forth that God gave to Israel. Anyway, so Nehemiah here was there, and he was very, very upset about, sad about his what is happening in Jerusalem. The gates were destroyed in some places. They weren't fixed, and there was a lot of distress on the survivors who were there. So I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was with fasting and praying before the Lord of, or God of heaven. And then it gives a long prayer that he gives, showing in detail his history. He understands the history of Israel what they went through, how they were given freedom from Egypt, and then went into the promised land, and then they were given God's law, and then they rebelled against it, and they were now in captivity. They were into other countries, and their land was taken away from them because of their sins. And he readily brought that out, how we have all sinned, we need your mercy, and so forth. And he appeals to God for his help. So he prayed, verse 5 through 11, very important prayer. He says, I pray, God in heaven, O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and keep and observe your commandments, let your ear be attentive and your ears open that you may hear the prayer of your servant. I pray you, and so forth. So we have acted very corruptly against you. Verse 7, we have not kept the commandments and statutes and ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. Remember, I pray, the word that you commanded your servants and said, if you're unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you are cast off to the farthest parts of heavens, I will gather you together. And, of course, that promise is still open for Israel, of course, at the end of the age, too. But there was another time before that he was going to allow those who wanted to come down to Jerusalem and go back to Judah from their far-flung areas of the Persian and the Babylonian Empire, where they were, for Judah at least. Now, Israel never did go back, you know, and never did come back from the far-flung areas of the world. That's still yet to happen, all the different tribes of Israel. And then he goes on, and he comes before the king because he was his cupbearer. Nehemiah had an important job there. He was with the king a lot. Chapter 2, came to pass in the month of Nisan, 20th year of Artaxerxes. This, a lot of people believe this is the same Artaxerxes that was a husband of Esther, and thought that Esther's and what happened with her happened pretty close to this time. And she had an influence, perhaps, on what happened here. It's kind of interesting. He was there. Wine was before the king. I took wine and gave it to the king. Now I never been sad in his presence before. Therefore, the king said to me, why is your face sad, Nehemiah, since you are not sick? There is nothing but sorrow of heart. Then I am dreadfully afraid. So he was concerned about Nehemiah. And so he said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face be so sad when the city and the place of my father's tombs lies waste and its gates are burned with fire over in Jerusalem? Then the king said to me, what do you request? I prayed to the God of heaven. Actually, when he was right there then, he put a silent prayer up to God, please, I hope this will work out okay. You know, even while he was before the king, he had a silent prayer quickly in his mind at least. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. The walls were broken down. Walls are very important to towns in those days, especially capitals and cities that had a lot of people in them, because they were protection against enemies coming in. You know, even today we have not walled cities in Florida. We have gated cities, don't we? Almost. I live in kind of a city, 700 homes or so in Regency Lakes, and it has a gate in the back and a gate in the front. And the gate in front has guards in the back. You can get through after you go through this complicated way to get in. Anyway, it's supposed to cut down on people coming in at night and maybe robbing you and stealing. And that's the whole idea. If you don't have a card to get in or whatever, it might cut that down. It didn't stop it all the way, but it has helped some to cut down that kind of activity, criminal activity on the homes, the people's homes. Anyway, so gates and walls were that way. Marauders coming at night, people stealing things out of people's houses, or enemy. And the gates were closed up, too, a lot of times in these towns at night to protect the people in that way. And, of course, they were very needed when the war came, of course, as we know. But anyway, he asked the king also, if you send me, and also verse 6 is interesting. So the king said to me, and then on an aside, the queen was also sitting beside him. Doesn't say what queen, but it's interesting. Why would it bring up that the queen is sitting beside him? Probably was Esther, but I can't say for sure. How long will your journey be to go? And when you return? And there he told him, and he said, if it please the king, let letters be given to me, verse 7, for the governors of the region beyond the rivers, that they may permit me to pass through it, that I come in a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he might give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, which pertains to the temple, for the city itself, and for the house that I may occupy. So the king granted him these letters, according to the good hand of my God upon me. So God was favoring him and helping him and giving him favor in the sight of Artaxerxes. So he received the authorities he needed in order to go there and get some good things done in Jerusalem. It's interesting when you look at this book and what was done here that Nehemiah used his heart because he cared for his brethren 760 miles away, and he had to go through desert country to get there. It probably was a very difficult trip to get there and do this. And also, he used his head, because you can see that when he got there, he did things in order. He did the right thing first. First, he found out, we go back and we see that he listened. He listened to the troubles and problems that somebody told him had happened back there. He wanted to know the news of his people. He was concerned for them. He cared. And he was distressed and upset about it. And he says, what can we do about this? This is very bad. And so then he went to God in his prayer and asked him for his help in this matter. So he included God in this situation, and he asked him for help and aid if it would be a good thing to help his people over in Judah. And since he allowed the people come back there, it must be a good thing. And so he prayed that way. So he put his ducks in a row, as you might say, and then he used his head. And he got God in there, he found out, and then he did something about it. He went to, and then the king gave him this opportunity to tell him why he was sad, and one thing led to another. All kinds of circumstances worked together that he could go. Now, the most intriguing thing to me in this whole book is the last words of Nehemiah. The very last words of the whole book. Why did he say this? And this is what he said. This is the very end of the book. He says, remember, O my God, remember me, O my God, for good. Remember me, O my God, for good. For the good deeds, the good things we did here, accomplished. That's interesting to me. Was he bragging about it or nothing? Did a lot of things there. And he had things done, and he accomplished a lot of things with other people's help and aid, certainly, a team, the leaders, and so forth. But he was a leader and got them going and doing different things that needed to be done for the good of God's glory and the good of the people there. Anyway, what good things did he do? It's kind of interesting. Well, chapter 2, verse, when he got to Jerusalem, chapter 2, verse 11, he did something kind of unusual. Not everybody would do this. He would do, as we would call it in Spokesman's Club in the old days, get the facts. Get the facts speech. Remember that one, boys, when you were in that? Get the facts. Find out what's really happening. Get the truth on something. And that's what he did. He came and he wanted to scout it out a little bit and find out what was the real situation there. He heard how it was, but let's see, you're going to see it for his own eyes. And I was there 3 days, and I woke in the night, rose up with a few men with me, and told nobody what my God had put into my heart to do in Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one I rode. I went out by night through the valley gate, serpent's gate, the refuge gate, viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which was broken down, and gates which were burned with fire. That was by the Babylonians. Then I went to the fountain gate and the king's pool, and there was no room for the animals, so I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall, and I turned back and entered into the valley gate, and so returned. So he went all around all the areas, all the gates of the walled city of Jerusalem that night, and didn't tell anybody about it. He didn't tell officials. He didn't tell the priests or anybody. And the officials did not know what I had done and what I had done, where I had gone and where I what I did. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, officials, or the others who did the work. Then I said to them, you got them together, the ones who were working, even the priests and the nobles and others, I got them together. And I said to them, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste, its gates are burned with fire. Now come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach to their enemies around them. Because remember, when the Babylonians took out, when Sennacherib took out the Israelites and took them over there to the Caspian Sea area, then he brought in other people from that area and other areas to replace them, Samaritans and others who had false religions, of course, and they replaced them. So they had all kinds of non-Jewish people in that area of Judah, and they had their religions and everything else. And I told them of the hand of God, which had been good upon me, upon the king's words which he had spoke to me, and let us rise up and do a good work. So he got them going, rebuilding the walls. Then Sanballat, a Horonite, Tobiah, the Ammonite official, he comes into it later, and Geshem, the Arab, heard of it, and they laughed us to scorn and despised us. This often happens, you find, among those who are enemies of the truth, enemies of the church, enemies of the Christianity, true Christianity. They despise you, they laugh you to scorn, they think you're foolish, you're dumb, you don't know very much. I've had that happen to me, that he doesn't know very much because he follows us, you know, the commandments and so forth. And we know more now. We're smarter. And they look down upon those who were actually trying to follow God's true way and enemies. And this is something that happens. But you have to be willing to take it because you know the truth. What is this thing you're doing? Will you rebel against a king? So I answered and said, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we and his servants will arise and build. You have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. Anyway, so they started building and they didn't have these other people around them. Later on, some of them came back and said, hey, we want to help you with the wall. No, stay away. We'll do it ourselves. He knew that they had wrong designs and they would try to do what they could, probably to sabotage what the work was being done. Slow it down or stop it somehow, accidents and things like that, on the workers, things like that they would cause. Whatever they could do to impede the building of the wall or fixing of the wall. He knew that. He was smart enough and wise enough, used his head. He says, no way, boys, we're fine, we're okay. Another time, they tried to get him to come over to a meeting they had out here out in the country someplace. And he figured they were conspiring, they're going to do something, might even kill him. So he says, no, I'm too busy with the job here of taking care of the wall. And he made an excuse, which they were doing, actually doing that work. And three, four times they came over and wanted him to come for that meeting. But he's too wise and too smart to fall for that trap. So he said, no, I'm too busy with the wall. I'm too busy with the wall. Which he was. But he did not trust them. And you couldn't trust some people because they were liars and they were trying to destroy what was done. They were destroying things before he got there. And that's what made a lot of distress on the workers who were trying to build the wall then. Anyway, so he got the facts. And he inspired the workers to come and do the work. Then the third thing, he dealt with his enemies, and we read about that a little bit, and took care of that, so they were not going to be impeding the work. Then another thing, he dealt with oppression. Over here in Nehemiah 5, Nehemiah the fifth chapter, interesting thing showing he had a heart. He cared for God's people. And that's important for a true leader of God's work. He has to care for the people. Care for the fact that some people are oppressed sometimes and they need help. And we try to follow that example today in the church when we see people need some help. They are oppressed somehow or another, to comfort them, to help them, and they don't suffer like they would if we didn't help them. Let's put it that way. And verse 1 of chapter 5, for instance, there's a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brethren. So as their own Jewish brethren are giving them an oppression. For there were those who said, "We and our sons and our daughters are many, therefore let us get grain for them that we may eat and live." They were starving. There were also some who came and said, "We have mortgaged our lands and vineyards and houses that we might buy grain because of the famine." And there were all those who said, "We borrowed money from the king's tax on our lands and vineyards." They taxed them pretty high. "And nor yet now our flesh is at the flesh of our brethren, our children, our sons and daughters are sold to be slaves. Some of our daughters have brought into slavery already. It is not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards." And before I was angry, and I became very angry and heard their outcry in these words. After serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and rulers and said to them, "Each of you is exacting usury from your brother." Usury was interest, but it was inordinate interest in this case, certainly. I looked at Adam Clark's commentary. He says, usually the interest rate was 1%. And all of us will say, that's nothing. 1%, so what? You know, that's hardly anything. 1% a month. 12% a year. That's what it was. 1% a month on your money. So you just figure that out. If you use the formula of 72 and you take what the rate of interest is and divide it by that, and you come, how many years it'll take to double the cost of something. And for instance, 12 goes into 72 how many times? 6 times? That means that 6 years you will pay double what you owe at 12%. So in 6 years, you'd have to pay, well, you borrowed $1,000, you're going to have to pay $2,000 back in 6 years, not just $1,000. Talk about inordinate interest and a burden on people. Some could never pay it back. It's like credit cards. People get these credit cards to pay, 15, 20%? And they find out all they can do is make the minimum payment each month. They can't pay it off. They got $40,000 they owe on it, and they're paying hundreds of dollars a month just for interest. It's a crime. It's a crime that people charge such interest on people. And the reason they do it is because a lot of people don't pay them back. They got bad credit risk. That's why they have such high interest. But people who pay really have to pay through the nose. But they were doing that back then. I think in the world of tomorrow, you're not going to see mortgages. I think mortgages will be a thing of the past. And I might be wrong in that, but the way it talks about here, it doesn't say anything good about people owing a lot of money and then going into debt and having all the kinds of problems from it. Anyway, let it go for now. But here he went in and he said, "What you're doing is not good," verse 9. "And should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? I also, with my brethren, my servants, am lending them money and grain. Please let us stop this usury. Restore now to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves, their houses, also the 100 parts of the money and grain, new wine." So they said, "We will restore it." And then they did. So they restored it to these people who were suffering, oppressed by their own Jewish brethren, leaders, rich people. People are getting rich there off them, taking over their land. It's like in the Dust Bowl days of the 1930s. How many farmers lost their land in the United States? They couldn't pay back the bank. They couldn't make the payments because they had no crops. The dust came in and destroyed any ability to make any kind of crop. And they were starving. They had to leave. A lot of them went to California, other places. As you remember that one novel by, I forget the name of the book. Anyway, doesn't matter. So here he dealt with that oppression. Then later on, after he went back, because he had to go back to Susa, to Elam in Persia, because the king says, when are you coming back? So he did come back after a while, and he was there for a while, and then he returned. He was allowed to return back to Jerusalem. And then he found something. It was interesting that Tobiah, this Ammonite, actually had quarters inside the temple area. And that was a no-no. According to the Bible, according to the law, God said, I don't want an Ammonite in there, in by my temple. And what had happened, the high priest, Eliashib, was kind of loose on things like that. And he let this fellow, probably a friend of his, I don't know, maybe paid him, I don't know. But he let him have a whole room that was supposed to be used for all the priestly things, the grain offerings and all these other things that had to do with the temple. And he let him have that room for his own use. And, of course, when Nehemiah found out about him, he went in there and kicked him out. Got rid of all his stuff and told the Levites, you need to be doing things according to what the law says you're supposed to handle. He found some of the people, in fact, were out working in the fields, who were Levites, and they were supposed to be taking care of the needs of the temple and all the responsibility. The singers, for instance, they were, instead of singing in the congregation and singing for different occasions in the temple, and rehearsing and making beautiful music, they were out there in the fields raising crops and so forth. And it kind of makes me think that we kind of did that with the church. Mr. Armstrong said, man, we need full-time men. We don't want them having a part-time job on the side. Yeah, I'm getting there. Okay. Anyway, so he did that. He took care of that. And also, at the end, he found people were bringing things in on the Sabbath and buying and selling. He got rid of them and closed the gates. And he said, now, if you find you guys coming back outside the gates, because they opened up the gates in the daytime, usually, except for the Sabbath in this case, he says, I'm going to lay my hands on you. So after that, they didn't show up. So he helped keep the Sabbath right. The seventh thing is he got rid of they found out that these men were married to women from Ashdod and Ammon and so forth, and their kids were speaking another language. And so he says, now, don't you see, you're not supposed to have your children marrying people from different races, different groups. They'll go off on their false religion. So he stopped that. What's this mean for us? Remember, O God, us for good, for our good deeds, doing God's work. Would God remember this? Well, let's look. Over here in Malachi 3, verse 16. This is probably written about the same time as Nehemiah, and it's believed that maybe Malachi was around at that time in that area. And he did say that the priesthood had gone, done evil and weren't treating God's way with the proper respect it deserved. And they were even had a bad attitude about even doing the work. Over here in Malachi, let's turn there. Did God remember the good work? Or does he remember the good work that people do? Well, Malachi 3, verse 16, it says, then those who feared the Lord spoke to one another, and the Lord listened and heard them. So a book of remembrance was written before him for those who fear the Lord and who meditate on his name. They shall be mine, and so forth. And then in Hebrews 6, verse 10, Hebrews 6, verse 10, also brings up this interesting thing about remembering. Does God remember for good the things that you do? and the good things we do. Now, if we do good things and we turn from God's way, well, that's another story. Ezekiel brings that out. But if you continue doing good things, keeping God's law, supporting and helping and aiding and praying for God's work, for instance, all these things. Hebrews 6, verse 10, it says, "For God is not unjust," Hebrews 6, verse 10, "God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love, which you have shown towards his name, in that you have ministered to the saints and do minister." Minister means serving. Serving the saints. Serving in any way you can to help grow in grace and knowledge and help others do the same. And so he says that we need faith and patience to do that. But God is not unjust to forget your good works. And so it's so interesting when you look at it that way, what it replies to Nehemiah also applies to us. Don't forget me. Don't forget us, God, for our good, for the good things that we do.